Oh, boy. Okay, hey, my name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981, and I'm grateful for that. And it's around this time, in almost every meeting I go to, that I start thinking it would have been a good idea to prepare. Oh, listen, we're going to talk about something tonight, maybe step two, maybe step three. It's going to be whatever you're ready to hear. You know, if you have 200 people or 300 people in the room, it's 300 different meetings, right? And it depends upon what's going on in you. And I was doing a meeting at the, I know some of you guys have heard the take Chicken on the Roof, and it's a true story. I was doing a meeting at the Homestead Group about 30 years ago, and when I first started doing these things, and I was doing, I don't know, I think it was the third or fourth step, I can't remember which one it was, and so I got up there and I did whatever I did, and I just knew it was the worst fourth step meeting that had ever been done in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, just the worst. And so I was saying to myself, you know, they just weren't getting my jokes. They weren't showing me the love I needed, you know. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you're also, please love me, aholic, you know. Why aren't you laughing at my jokes, aholic, you know. Please accept me, aholic, you know. I mean, you look at that bar scene, you know, you say, will I be good enough? Will they accept me? You know, will the group like me? And then you take a couple of slugs of scotch and you feel like you own the freaking group, you know, and you got to accept them, you know. But, you know, you're sober, you know, you're out there and you want so much people, you know, you'll do anything. You'll prostitute yourself. You'll say anything, you know, and you just want to know exactly how you have to act so that people will like you. You know, I've spent more money I don't have, buying more things I don't need to impress people I don't like you can possibly imagine, just maxing up. You know, because they're not like me for me, you know, you got to have all these accoutrements. And so anyway, I went to this room and I just didn't feel the love, and it was terrible. It was a horrible experience, and I knew it was the worst meeting. And so I was on step four, and so I had determined, I walked out of the meeting. What did I say? Why did I say that? Why didn't they let, you know? Worrying about all that stuff. I learned something that meeting. I learned something about the 12th step. I learned something about the 12th step at that meeting. And I said to myself, you know, self, I said, I'm not going back there. Because if you're an alcoholic, if something's uncomfortable, you're an excuse-aholic. I mean, any alcoholic worth his salt can excuse himself out of anything. You know, I'd call him up and say, you know, my like father died, or, you know, I had smallpox, or, you know, anthrax, or whatever the heck I had to do to get it. I wasn't going to go back there. They didn't love me. It was embarrassing, you know, because I had just done the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. But of course, the one good thing I had going for me, I didn't have a lot of good things going for me, but the one good thing I had going for me is, more than anything, I didn't want to drink. Now, I cannot tell you how much a desire not to drink can help you in this deal. I mean, if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be thrashed by abusive and unreasonable sponsors. You're going to hear all sorts of crap that is absolutely preposterous and stupid. People are going to embarrass you. They're going to humiliate you. You're going to have your feelings hurt. You're going to want to run out the door and say, screw this stuff. I don't need this crap. You're going to want to excuse yourself from meetings. You're going to want the worst way to get the hell out of here, because this is a bunch of bullshit. You're going to want to do a lot of things. And I'll tell you something, if you're an alcoholic, you're going to do it. You're just going to leave. You're going to tunnel your way out of here. It's going to be like The Great Escape, if you ever saw that movie. I know some of you are, you know, not old enough. The Great Escape, you may be in prison, but you're digging that tunnel. You're digging that tunnel. You're figuring out how you're going to have balance in your life, you know, how you're going to turn it into like one meeting every 3 months or something like that. And that's the way I used to drink. I used to walk in the bar at 4:30 in the afternoon. You know, I'd leave about half an hour before work at around 4:30 in the afternoon, and I'd leave the bar at 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the morning. Well, how many hours is that?
12.
Spending 12 hours in a bar was easy for me. Now, sometimes I'd spend 3 or 4 hours in a bar, and then I'd get in my car and I'd drive drunk to the next bar. Mm. I do like the circuit, you know what I mean? Yeah. But spending 12 hours drinking was easy for me. I didn't even think it was any problem. And I had a wife and a kid at home. And she was under the crazy delusional thinking that I should like show up for dinner or something like that. You know what I mean? And I'd be there drinking at 4:30 with the guys, you know, and before I knew it was like 7:30, and I'd pick up the phone, she's waiting dinner, and I'd say, I'll be there. I just stopped in the bar. This is what I'd say. I'd be there already for 3 hours, and I'd get on the phone and I'd say, I just got to the bar, because 3 hours is like just getting there for me. You know what I mean? That's in geologic time. It's very short. You know what I mean? 3 hours. I just got to the bar, and I've got to talk to Steve, to Doug about some business, about a case that's coming up. You know, but I'm coming home. I'll be home in a half an hour. You know what I mean? Or whatever I'd say to her to sort of calm her down. And then around 9:30, I'd get on the phone again to call her up, and I'd say something. Well, there's no excuses at that point, because, you know, on the other end of the phone, you know, she's kind of frosty. You know, it's kind of frosty deal. And so I'd say something like this. I'm out the, honey, listen, I'm out the door. Which is alcohol code for it. You ain't never seeing me again. You know what I mean? And I was out the door. I was out to the next bar. I was going to Ronnie's or something like that. And she'd see me at 4 o'clock in the morning. And apparently, I found out sometime in the midst of the divorce that she did not appreciate that deal. You know, so that's the deal. So in any event, but that's the way I drank. I drank like 12 hours at a time. You know, and you know, you come to AA, and you know what happens? You come to AA, and you go to like one meeting for 1 hour, and then somebody says, "Well, come back," and you say, "Well, wait a second, I want to get some balance in my life. I want to balance this thing out." You know, yeah, balance. It's the first time I ever worried about balance when I came to AA. That means as few meetings as possible in order to stay sober. But what happened was, more than anything else, I wanted to stay sober. So when that happens, when your thinking starts, your alcoholic thinking, you know, the grouch in the brain, those brainstorms, you get these brainstorms. I told my sponsor when I was like 1 week sober, I was feeling a little bit better. I woke up one morning, I was 1 week sober, there was cash on the dresser. I said, where the flip did that come from? Cash on the dresser, you know what I mean? Money, you know? I had money left, you know? That never happened when I was drinking. And I was starting to feel good, you know? All of a sudden I was starting thinking again, which is always dangerous. And so I had started figuring these things out, and I remember telling my sponsor Bob, I didn't think I had to go to meetings on Thursday. I had figured it out because I was trying to get. I said, Bob, I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursdays, you know. He said, what do you think about that? He says, well, sure, Russ, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. And I said, well, of course I drank every day, just about. And I said, you know, and then he said, Russell, listen. You know, now listen, I was a postgraduate, departmental honors in mathematics, a lawyer from law school. I picked some bozo to sponsor me that didn't even graduate high school, you know what I mean? But he had me at a disadvantage because I was shaky and I came in here, I had like two neurons working and they were like waving goodbye to each other, you know? And I'd be carrying on a conversation, which is always good for a trial lawyer. I'd be carrying on a conversation, and midway in the sentence, I'd forget what I was talking about. And sort of like what's happening tonight. It hasn't progressed much. But in any event, because you're trying to wonder, am I ever going to get back to Homestead again? Which is going to happen. But in any event, so what was I talking about? In any event. So he said to me, he looks at me, my sponsor would say to me, my first sponsor, he'd say to me, Bob, so he'd say, you know, Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. And I'd look at him, I'd sit there and I'd say, what does that mean? You know? I had been alive, I came to AA when I was 31 years old. I had been through college, postgraduate, law school. I had been a division chief in the state's attorney's office, trying murder cases, worked with cops. I swear to God, at 31 years of age, at 31 years of age, I had never had anybody say anything like that to me in my entire life. I didn't know what he was talking about. You know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. What is that? So I'm thinking, I have like no reference points. It's not like I've heard this before. So what I did was I saw a word, this is true, I saw a word picture. At that time, and I don't even know where they have it now, RCA Victor, RCA had a logo with a dog with like a patch in his eye looking into a Victrola, you know, like a speaker. And a cute little dog in the street. So I started picturing that dog. I started picturing a doggy family. You know, like a doggy daddy and like a doggy mommy and like three little doggies. I'm trying to, like, a dog knows about his father. And like after 5 minutes midway into this deal, I started realizing a dog doesn't know his father. You know? And I thought he was complimenting me. So that's the way I was. That's kind of like the way I was brought up. And so what happens is, you know, because my sponsor was constantly hurting my feelings and saying mean things to me and being obnoxious and stuff like that. But what happens is that when you don't want to drink, even though you want to say, well, screw this stuff, I'm going to get another sponsor, I'm going to kid, you know, if somehow you tie in what the, here's what you realize, but I'm not drinking. But I'm not drinking. And you start somehow, deep down inside, you sort of tie in the fact that you're not drinking to your sponsor, or you're not drinking to your group, or you're not drinking to something. And the bottom line is that you ain't going nowhere. You ain't going nowhere. I mean, you know, people will say, well, I drank because you told me this. I said, you didn't drink. Hey, if I piss you off to the extent that you got to drink, you can use that as, use whatever excuse you need if you want to go out and drink. It's perfectly fine with me. You could say, you go out and drink and come back and say, it's Russell's fault. That's fine with me. You might as well get it over now. If I'm the impetus to prune you off the tree and get you out there so you need business, that's fine. But I know if you're serious about this thing, there's nothing I can say that's going to blow you out of here. There's nothing that's you're going to hear that's going to blow you out of here. There's nothing that's going to happen to you that's going to blow you out of here, because no matter how bad it is, you don't want to drink. And if you want to drink, there's nothing that's going to be said in here that isn't going to piss you off. And there's nothing that's going to happen to you that isn't going to be some excuse for saying, well, screw this, I'm leaving. And it's just all bullshit. It's just your alcoholic thinking, trying to blame somebody else for the fact that you just don't want to grow up, you know, and accept responsibility and be a man or a woman. You know, just you want to remain the thumb-sucking crybaby feeling sorry for yourself. That's the bottom line. So I digress. In any event, I wouldn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know what I mean? Somebody, who was it? Was it you, John? You said you thought you heard the tape, you thought I was a little bit too strong on the first step. Well, you know where I wind up on the 12th step. So if I start off strong, it's going to get real bad. It's going to get real hot in here. So in any event, so the fact is, you know, he would say, my sponsor would say things like that, and I'd get mad at him, but I would stick. I would stay around. Because I knew he had stuff. So even though I left the meeting, you know, because my feelings were hurt, whatever the heck it was, you know what I mean? And saying, oh, I'm not going back there because I was scared, or I was worried, or I didn't think they liked me. I mean, God forbid, if you're an alcoholic, the worst thing in the world was over. Oh, my God, I don't think they liked me. You know, I said to my, oh, what will drive you crazy? You know, man, you want to really drive me crazy? Say, you know what so-and-so said about you? Oh, my God, you know, that's, you know, oh, my God, the thought that people are thinking of bad things about me. And, of course, they're always thinking about me, because, hell, I'm always thinking about me, so they must be thinking about me, and, you know, I'm selfish, self-centered, you know, what is it, what's the whole point, the base of disease, selfish, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, stuff, and all we do is think about ourselves, we figured everybody else is thinking about ourselves, bad crap, you know, and why did I say that at the meeting, you know, what am I going to say, why did I say that, what do they think, all that crap, you know, just a horrible way of living. It's just rough being an alcoholic, it's rough out there. You know, always worried about what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day, because something you did the last day or something like that. It's always next week, next year, all that sort of stuff, all those fears and all that crap. And you don't even know you're in trouble, because it's just the way you've been thinking all your life. And you're alcoholic thinking, it seems the only normal way of thinking. You don't even know how to think other than you think. You don't even know you're in fear. You're just thinking the way you always think, and it's crappy, bad thoughts about yourself and other people. But every once in a while, you can have a drink, and that'll make you sort of calm down and feel better. But what do you do when you stop drinking? That's the real disease. That's the real disease. The real disease shows up when you stop drinking, and it feels like the way you feel like when you're not drinking. The real disease, you know, if you're an alcoholic, the real disease feels like sobriety. Anybody sober here? Well, you are right in the center of it. So when you walk out of here and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the voices are coming and the committee's talking to you and the 15,000 voices about this, that, and the other thing, how are you going to pay the rent, how are you going to do this, what's going to happen, what's going to happen next year, you know, right? What are you going to live, you're going to die, all that sort of stuff, you say, well, what's wrong with it and everything like that, that's, you're in the battle. That's the deal. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Comes at once by taking a few drinks. That's why I drank. There's no woman, no suit of clothes, no amount of money worked just quite as well as just a few drinks. So I defy you to drink alcohol. How to do for you what it did for me and stop. You ain't going to do it. It just worked better than anything else. So what happens, even though I walked out of the door of that homestead group saying, well, I ain't going back there again because, you know, because they didn't like me. God forbid somebody should have resentment against me. I call them up 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, did I do something to offend you? You know, I understand Ralph doesn't like me, you know. And you know, I asked my sponsor, Joe Snyder, once. I said, do you still get resentments? He said, get them. I give them. I said, oh. I said, I couldn't believe these guys. Yeah, I mean, he was like talking my whole life. You know. Of course, I'm a typical alcoholic. I say, well, I don't give a crap what they say. I don't give a crap. I could give a crap what they think about me. I don't give a crap what they say about me. But what you ultimately realize is anybody who says they don't give a crap what people think about them, all they do is think all day about what other people think about them. They dress so people think about them a certain way. They buy their cars so people think about them. Their whole life is about vanity and making themselves look a certain way so other people will think about them a certain way. And all they do is think about what other people think about them, because people that really don't think about what other people think about them don't say or even think, I don't care what they think about me. They say things like pass the ketchup, but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? They say other stuff, you know? But that's part of alcohol bullshit, to make believe. You know, if you tell yourself enough times you don't care what other people think about you, you start thinking you really don't think what other people think about you, and then you start worrying about popping Xanax because you worry why you feel so crappy, worrying about what other people think about you. And how could it be that? Because you don't care about what other people think about you, and you just live a lie. And the first step of getting out of jail is knowing you're in jail in the first step. And you don't even, in the first instance, and you don't even know what the jail looks like. You think it's alcohol and drugs, and it ain't alcohol and drugs. That's just the symptom. You know, after you take away the alcohol and drugs, you're still in jail. You're still locked up. So even though I left that homestead group saying I ain't going to go back again, I knew I was going back, because somehow hanging out with my sponsor, I knew once you make a commitment, you fulfill the commitment. He says whenever, he would say stuff to me and not explain it. He would say, do this or you do that. There'd never be like a conversation, like why should I or anything. He said, just what you do. He said, he gave me a 24-hour book. He said, every morning, read this book, get on your knees and ask God's help to stay sober. I don't remember him asking me whether I believed in God or not. I don't believe he asked me, and I don't remember saying, well, why should I do that? He just gave me the book and told me to do it. He said, call me up before you take the drink. He said, don't call me up after you take the drink. Call me up before you take the drink. We didn't have like a long conversation as to why I should do it. It was just, this is what you do. He just gave me instructions and how I was supposed to live and what I was supposed to do, and I just did it. And I guess I did it. Well, why would I do that? Well, it says in the big book, it says in the 12 12 why I would do that, because no self-respecting alcoholic would do any of this stuff if you didn't think you had to do it to stop drinking and live. Because I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to drink, so I did the stuff without question. You know, I mean, listen, when you have to start explaining the explanation to an alcoholic, stop it. It's no use, because they want to drink anyway. You know, some guy comes up to you, you know, I'm kind of stupid. I was assuming when a guy comes up and he says, will you sponsor me? It's because he wants what I have. And so if I tell him something, he's going to do it. He starts saying, well, why should I do it? I say, well, why did you ask me to sponsor you? I'm not here. I'm not debating. I don't want anything. You know, some guy called me up once. He said, you know, you sponsor me and you never call me. I said, why would I do that? Why would I be calling you? I don't know what I think you have. You know, but I think I hurt his feelings. So I knew, even though I left the homestead group, I knew I was going back, because somehow I tied in. I think it has something to do with integrity. I think this disease has something to do with the lack of integrity. That's why I think they'll never invent a pill to fix this disease unless they have like an integrity pill, you know. But and once you take the integrity pill, there goes your integrity. So in any event, so whatever. So I knew if I had integrity and I told them I'd come back, I had to come back, and somehow tied in my integrity and my commitment to drinking, and I didn't want to drink, so I was come back even though it was going to hurt or suffer. So I came back the next week to do the fifth step. I came back to the group that I had just done the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now think about it. Now you're sober and you're asked to do a meeting. I want you to try to put yourself in my place if you can possibly do that. You do a meeting at a group, and you know It's the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know they're all thinking about you. You know they're all laughing at you. You know you're humiliated because you know you did the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, they've been telling their friends, you got to see this guy. He does the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? And now you're going back to that group. You understand what I'm saying? So, you know, he said, now you're going back to that group. And I get to the group and I sit at the mic, you know what I mean, or wherever it is they had there. And before the meeting starts, this guy comes up to me and says, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah. What is it? He says, well, my name's Joe. And I said, he says, I only have, a month or so. And he says, I just want to tell you, you saved my life last week. I said, excuse me? He says, you saved my life last week. I said, I saved your life? He said, yeah. He says, I was going to go out and drink. I only had about a month, and my wife has left me, and my kids have left me, and I'm under indictment for first-degree mopery, and I lost my job, and I don't have any money, whatever the heck it was. And he says, and I was going to go out and drink. He says, but, I just decided to go to this one meeting, and I thought, maybe I'll go to this one meeting, maybe this guy, and I sat in the back of the room, and I was sort of listening to what you had to say. And he says, when you said the chicken was on the roof, it like all came together for me. I saw the whole picture. I understood everything. Everything meshed together. And I understood what my sponsor said. And I understood why my wife left me. And everything got beautiful. And you saved me. And, while he's talking, the chicken on the roof, I said, well, I sort of knew what he was talking about because I had been talking a little poultry there, you know what I mean? I knew the deal he was, but I didn't say the chicken was on the roof. I said, he got it all wrong. I said, like, the turkey's in the oven or something like that. He was saying chicken's on the roof. He was talking about something I never said, you know what I mean? And now, listen, I took credit for it. I said, oh, yeah, chicken on the roof, my favorite line, Say it all the time, chicken on the roof. What I'm known for, but here's the deal. You see, this is the incredible thing. You see, I walk out of here thinking, first of all, you see, I thought what the 12 steps said was we carry the message. That's what I thought the 12 steps said. And so when you think your job is to carry the message, then you have to worry about whether you're carrying the message. You got to worry about what other people are thinking about you. You have to worry about what the other people are thinking, how they're receiving this, whether they're going to drink or not. If they drink, that's because it's your fault. You know what I mean? If they didn't drink, you get the credit. I mean, it's all about you carrying it. You have a heavy responsibility. You got to carry the message. And here's this guy, and he stayed sober thinking this was that the worst meeting in the world, that I thought was the worst meeting in the world, was the greatest meeting for him, and he'd stay sober based upon something he heard me say that I didn't even say. And I realized that the way the AA works is that I don't have to carry the message. All I got to do is try to carry the message. It's a big difference. Which means I show up and I try to do the best job I can do on the night I'm doing it. So it was probably the worst 4-step meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was the best meeting I could do that night. And what happened is Turkey on the basement floated across the room and hit this guy who was sitting in the back of the room who was missing a piece from his heart. He was missing a piece. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know what the piece was. And what happened was, he knew what that guy needed to hear. So Turkey on the basement floats across the room, goes into this guy's ear, Turkey on the basement, and he hears chicken on the roof. And get this, and I get the credit. I get the credit for that deal. And everybody in that meeting is hearing what they're supposed to hear, and it has nothing to do with what my message is or whether I'm, it has to do with me showing up and trying to do the best job. And when you look at it, if you look at Bill Wilson's story, remember his story? He was, Ebbie Thatcher came to see him. He had a bottle of scotch or a bottle of whiskey. He said, you want something to drink? And Ebbie said, he says, no, thank you. I got religion. He says, hey, it's okay. More for me. And he keeps on drinking. And the more Evie's talking, the more Wilson is drinking. Wilson is getting drunk while Evie's trying to tell him about God, about religion, about that deal. You understand what I'm saying? And Bill Wilson, and he leaves. Evie leaves. And when imagine this, when Evie left Bill Wilson was half lit up. He was half drunk. I don't know about you, but Evie Thatcher probably thought, well, man, that was the worst 12-step call I've ever made. That thing didn't work. And as a result of that 12-step call, Bill Wilson got sober and wrote this book with the help with other people. And as a result of that 12-step call, you guys are all sober tonight. As a result of the worst 12-step that was ever done by anybody, because he was trying to carry the message, you guys are all sober. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, you get up here, and, you know, with the help of the Holy Spirit, you know, you try to do the best job you can. What is it? What the hell does it matter what I say? Half of you aren't hearing it anyway. There's all sorts of music and spheres going on inside that deal. And so that's this is such an incredible program, the way this thing works. So I get on my knees. I want to talk about, since this is presumably around the second step, I'm going to talk a little bit about the first few months, some of the things that happened to me. You know, it says in the big book, if you want, we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You know, right? This is a step series, right?
Yes.
Okay, so when are you ready to take the steps?
Now.
No. Now listen. Let me try to explain this. If you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So, now here's the deal. There is a step before the steps. Listen, there's a step. There's a prerequisite. Anybody ever go to college? You know, before you take, like, you know, calculus, you got to take algebraic geometry. Before you take that, you got to take trigonometry. There's like, they have things called prerequisites. You know what I mean? You try to push this through, it's all nice, but unless you've got that prerequisite going, there's a prerequisite to taking the steps, which has to do with, you ready for this? Attitude. Attitude is important in here. And the attitude they're talking about, you ready for this? Is something called desire. Now listen, you can force somebody to take the steps. You can tell them they're going to go to jail until they take the steps. You can say they're not getting out of treatment until they do their fourth step. You can threaten them with all sorts of things. And you can have them mechanically do this stuff. And maybe it'll work, but they won't work. But there's no way you can get people. You cannot. I don't know how to do the attitude thing. I don't know how to do the desire thing. I can't. I don't know how to make somebody all of a sudden repent and want to turn around and say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of being a child. I'm sick and tired of being a thumb-sucking crybaby. I want to grow up. I want to be a man. I want to be this. I don't know how to get somebody to the point where they say, I want to be like that guy. I want to be like that gal. I want to be like that. I don't know how to get somebody to do that. I know at any AA room, there'll be one guy saying, man, I want what that guy has. I don't know what he has, but I want to be like that guy. And there'll be three guys in the parking lot smoking and saying, what an asshole that guy is. And I don't know about that magic or how to make that happen. And that has nothing to do with me or anything. That has to do with whatever's going on inside of you. You with me? But I know this. The big book says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I know when you read the stories of the people and the people that make it, the guys that make it are the guys that want this thing so bad, they desire it so bad, they do whatever they have to do to get it. They don't call up their sponsor and say, you know, you never call me. They don't worry about that. Why should they worry about it? Because they're always calling their sponsor.
Right.
You know, they're not calling up their sponsor saying, you know, we never get together. It's hard for me to get together because they're always wherever he is because they know where he is and that's when they show up. I mean, it's a difference between desire and just bullshitting yourself and really doing it. And the step of before the steps is if you want what we have. So the first thing you need to have is a we. Because how can you want what we have if you don't have a we? If you don't have a person or a group of people where you are following them around, like I was following around my sponsor. And he introduced me to other people. And I didn't even know what they had. I didn't know what they had, but I knew what I had and whatever I had. And I didn't even know what I had, but it was a bad. It was a bad deal. You understand what I'm saying? And they had a good deal. You know what I mean? They may have been crazier as a loon. You know what I mean? But whatever they had was a lot better than I had. And I wanted their deal. I wanted to be like them. I'm an alcoholic. I want to be like them, like that. Immediately, I want to be like them. I hear some guy with 20, 30 years. I want to have 20, 30 years like in a week. You know, I want it immediately. So what that has me do is it has me submit myself to authority. man, if there's anything alcoholic, Satan more is to submit themselves to somebody's authority. Mm. I'm my own man. I'm the captain of my ship. Nobody tells me. Who the hell do you think you are anyway? Nobody tells me what to do. Who the hell do you think you are? You know, I do what I want to do. Screw you. You don't know who... Hey, you don't know who you're dealing with. You have any idea who you're dealing with? You don't know who you're screwing. That's alcohol. That's out. You know what that is? You hear that happening? You thinking that stuff? You know what that is? That's the disease. That'll... Yeah, he said, you know, I just say to my sponsor, he says, well, that's just my personality. He says, hey, your personality is killing you. But I love my personality because I'm a man and I'm strong and everything. That's horseshit. And you just can't give up because you feel so crappy about yourself and you think you're such a loser that you got to make-believe with this make-believe dialogue in your own brain and to other people to make them think you're a big shot or you're grandiose or you're something when you know deep down inside you are nothing, you're always going to be a nothing, you've always been a nothing. And that was my problem. I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. It didn't matter how many degrees I had. It didn't matter where I worked. It didn't matter what my car was. No matter what. And I had to surround myself with all that stuff. I had to be the lawyer. I had to have the car. I had to have the good looking. I had to have all that stuff because with all that stuff, I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. I used to put something in my stomach to turn me into an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world. And that's my deal. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. That's the kind of alcoholism I suffered from. I mean, everything's okay, you know, but what do you... Okay, so I got to stop drinking? Drinking's the only thing that ever worked for me. So now I stop drinking. Now what am I going to do? I'm a nothing. I'm a piece of crap. You know what I mean? I don't care what I tell you. That's the deal. That's the alcoholism. So I run into some guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden I'm looking at this guy, and I want what he has. Somebody says I should ask him to be my sponsor, you know, and I'm scared to ask him to be my sponsor. I'm scared. I said, how do you ask somebody to be a sponsor? You should go up and ask him. You know what I mean? 31 years old, I'm scared to ask another man, you know, to be my sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? What if he says no? You know, well, I don't give a shit what other people think about me. What? Bullshit. My whole life is, does anybody have a question? Well, I have a question, but if I ask a question, maybe people think it's stupid. Anybody have the answer? Well, I have the answer, but what if I'm wrong? You know what I mean? It's all about that idea of being scared to do anything. Scared to leave a relationship, because if I leave a relationship, I'll be alone and I'll never have another guy or another gal. You're always scared to leave a job. That's a crappy job because you got to apply for another, clear to apply for another job. It's all about being stuck in a situation, being crappy and horrible situations because you can't move, you can't change the things, don't have the courage to change the things. Because you're so scared inside and you think you're such a piece of crap. How do you fix that stuff? I mean, the drinking, you can stop the drinking. How do you stop the thinking? How do you stop the fear? How do you stop the paralysis of fear? How do you stop the worry and the anxiety and all that stuff? How do you stop that deal? Huh? So, I wanted what these guys had. I go to a meeting. Oh, man, it was so unbelievable. These guys were unbelievable. You know, these things that are going on in my life now that I don't even, well, I appreciate it all. I appreciate my life now. I've got six kids, I've got four kids, six grandkids, a wife of 32 years, you know, sponsor, one of the privileged to sponsor, but I got a bunch of sponsees in here. Got some grand sponsees. Got some great grand sponsees. I even met one great, great grand sponsee. You know, they're all, you know, unbelievable. How do you get that deal from a hapless, helpless drunk? How do you get that deal happening? And so my sponsor says to me, and I'll tell you, if you're an alcoholic, let me tell you something, this is a serious disease. You are, let me be this way, I'll give you a little, if you're an alcoholic, you're crazy. You understand what I'm saying? You're crazy. If you're an alcoholic, here's the problem, you're crazy. Don't get upset about it. Don't panic, you know. That's the problem. You're crazy. Now, you should actually get a certain sense of feeling pretty good about that. Because when you leave and you're driving home and the stuff happens, you know what I'm talking about? Those thoughts, the craziness, you know, eating the dead babies, all that crap. You know what I mean? You know, whatever the hell's going on in your mind that you know if anybody ever hears this, they're locking you up because you are one freaking nutcase. You know what I mean? Who thinks this stuff, be assured that every other person in the room is thinking the same crap, and they're all nuts, and the only reason it's happening is because you're crazy. You understand what I'm saying? And you don't know, you don't have any good thoughts. You have no good thoughts. All your thoughts are shitty thoughts about yourself and other people. Now, I happen to be a Christian guy. You don't have to become Christian, so I believe in Satan and all that sort of stuff, and you can turn me off now if you want. So I happen to believe that we have an enemy out there. We have a spiritual enemy out there, and I blame it on him. Which is okay with me because it helps me because I can fight his ass. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? But the bottom line is whether you want to blame it on him or you want to think, just understand that you are crazy and this shit is going to happen to you forever unless you get some sort of tools in your life to battle that crap and replace those thoughts with good thoughts and decent thoughts, you're going to be battling with this disease on a different level that has nothing to do with booze for the rest of your life. Unless you can escape, get that escape velocity out of the planet Earth, the gravitational pull of this disease will pull you back in, and you will eventually drink, drug, get involved with porn, get crazy relationships, something will happen just to assuage you, because you may not be drinking, but you'll feel like a piece of crap no matter what the hell you say. Amen. And you just won't be able to get away from the thinking. Because it's crazy, the way we think, the way we act, the way we are. And I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about grown-ups. 50-year-olds that act like 2-year-olds. Grown-ups that don't get it. My sponsor says, I want you to join a home group. I don't even know what I told you guys, but I want you to join a home group. And he says, so I went over, he says, check out a home group. I said, well, what group do you belong to? He says, nah, you wouldn't like that group. He says, you're trying to keep me from this. I eventually joined this group. So I went over to the South Aid room. I sit in the back of the room. I sit all the way in the back of the room. You know, I'm sitting all the way in the back. And I see these guys, you know how we are, you know, they're all high-fiving themselves, you know, they're high-fiving themselves, they're all on tables, they're little cliques, you know, and talking. So I sat in the back of the room waiting for them to recognize how wonderful I was and that the Emperor of A had walked in the room and elected me president, and the mic was going around or whatever, and everybody was talking and saying bullshit, and they weren't even, and I was the new guy in the room. I was like, this guy over here, nobody's asking me, you know, if they only knew who was here, you know what I mean? I would explain to them what's really going on, and it's like they didn't even care. Love and talk. They don't even. It's like they don't even care. Nobody came up to me. Nobody shook my hand. Nobody asked me what my opinion was. You know, and there was me, and there was them, and they were having such a good time, and they were laughing, and I was alone, and everything like that. And it went around the room, and the meeting ended. And I didn't even have a chance to speak. You know, and it's like they didn't even care. And I got up, and I walked out. And I went, and I had about 2 months or something like that. And I went up to my son. So he said, how'd you like the South Aid room? And I said, it was crap. I said, it's a crappy group. That's a terrible group. He says, it's a bunch of cliques. They don't give a crap about anybody. You know, I was a new guy. Nobody came up to me. It was crappy and everything like that. It's just a bunch of cliques. So my sponsor says, now this is why sponsors are so stupid. I'm explaining to him the facts. The logical fact, I mean, I'm not lying. I just told you exactly what happened. Do you understand? I just told you exactly what happened. They didn't talk to me. They didn't go up to me. They didn't ask my opinion. I didn't get the mic. I walked out of the room. Nobody stopped me. They didn't ask me nothing. I think we can all agree, crappy, shitty group. In violation of every precept of Alcoholics Anonymous. The newcomer is the most important guy in the room. That's why they all clap for you. Certainly not because you're good looking or anything, you know. I mean, that's no, you're wonderful. But in any event, the bottom line is this. And they didn't do this. So here's the deal. So my sponsor says, you know, because I like people to say, you're right, they're all assholes. That's what I like. I like people that agree with me. And he says, well, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to show up to that group again and join one of the cliques. I mean, would an alcoholic, if you were in a bar and drinking and talking about the assholes that you went to in that room, would your drinking buddy say that to you? Or would he join in the melody? You're right, that group's a stupid group, that's an idiot group, they're stupid, you know, that's, I don't know about you, but my alcoholic thinking, which seems the only normal one, is about the blame. It's about to say, yeah, you're right. You know, there's nothing too good. It's too good to be true. For an alcoholic, it's always too good to be true. You understand? If it's too good to be true. It's good, can't be true. If it's bad, must be true. That's the way I think. That's just the way it's too good to be true. People are too good to be true. You don't understand? You know, that's the way I am. And here's this guy. This is what he says to me. Where do you get stuff like this? I'm telling him what a crappy group it is. He should have told me to join to another group. Go to another group. He says, I want you to go back to the group. And I want you to join one of the cliques. So, first of all, the guy's obviously stupid. So let me ask you this. I think it's time to get another sponsor. I don't know about you. Somebody who appreciates me or understands. So, but I didn't want to drink. And I thought my drinking, not drinking, had something to do with this sponsor. So you know what I did? I went back to the group. And I walked up to one of the tables. And I said, hi, my name is Russell. I'm brand new. I said, hey, buddy, how you doing? He said, sit on down. So I sat down, and they started talking to me, and I started talking to them. They said, hey, would you like to do the meeting? I said, can I? I said, sure. So I did the meeting and everything like that. And they said, and then I was finishing the meeting. And they came up and you know what they said? They said, hey, keep coming back, you know? And I walked out and I saw my sponsor. He says, so how was the meeting? He says, man, that's the greatest crew. They must have had like all new people. You know what I'm talking about? It's like the group is like incredible, you know? Same group, same people, same deal. You know what I mean? Now, I would have not figured that out on the bet. To figure out that it's not their responsibility, it's my responsibility. That it has to do with my thinking. It has to do with my perception. It has to do with me. It doesn't have to do with it. How would a self-respecting alcoholic with the disease we have, the crazy disease we have, with all the rationalizations, how we rationalize, we tell ourselves rational lies that we believe that seem so true about reality, how would I ever figure out that the solution to that was to go back and put out my hand and say, my name's Russell? Do you think I would ever figure that out? Never. I'd be drunk and for the rest of my life, you know what I'd be saying? I'd be sitting in some bar somewhere, drunk and dying, saying, I've been to AA, it doesn't work. That's what would be going on. And so my sponsor said to me, he said, we're going to do it. You know what one day at a time is? When you knew one day, you know, you hear that thing, one day at a time, the serenity prayer? You know, and I never figured this out before. You know how many, you guys do that one day at a time thing, right? Boy, isn't that a bit, what about that? What is that one day at a time thing? Living one day at a time, living in the moment. You know what that is? That's a spiritual exercise to help you believe in God. You didn't know that. That's a spiritual exercise to help. Every time you try to live one day at a time, you're saying, I want to believe in God. You didn't know that. So let me rip the covers off of that lie so you can stop doing it, okay? The reason we can't live one day at a time, the reason why you're crazy and you're scared and you're fearful, and I was fearful, and if I was fearful, you know, one thing, one of the lies, one of the old ideas we have is that we're different. That's an old idea. You know, we have old ideas, you know, that we have to get rid of, or the result was, you know, one of the old ideas we have is nobody will understand. Nobody can ever understand me. Nobody can ever understand, because I'm like unique, I'm different. And we actually think that all our thoughts are unique, all our sins are unique, everything we've done is unique. Nobody can possibly understand us because we're so different, we're so unique, when the truth is we're all like twins, you know what I mean? That's why we go to meetings and we love hearing stuff like this, because we sit there and say, like, guys come up and he says, you were talking about me. I know you were looking at me, weren't you? You know, I mean, you're talking, because we're all exactly the same. We're anything but unique. If you had a thought, chances are I had that thought. If you had a problem, chances are I had that problem. You know, we may look a little different, but we're the same deal. And you know, I'm sitting there, and so I'm sitting there, and I'm worried. And you know what I worry about? 90% of the stuff I worry about is none of my business. Absolutely none of my business. It has nothing to do with me. I get guys that come up to me with problems, incredible problems, that's crowding their brain, that's driving them crazy about their sister, their cousin, their brother, their dad, the this, the that, the world situation, the president, what's going on with Obama, whatever, terrible problems. And I say, let me ask you something. He says, what? What? They want the answer. And I said, what does this have to do with you? And they say, what? I says, what does this have to do with you? He says, well, there's problems in the world and there's stuff. And I said, yeah, but what does this have to do with you? He says, well, you see, but I want to know about the, you know, you got it. I said, but what does this have to do with you? Just tell me what it has to do with you and then we'll talk about it. And they think about it and they think about it and says, well, it doesn't have anything to do with me. I said, okay, forget that problem. And then I say, well, now how do you feel? He says, well, I feel okay. So 90% of the shit that you guys worry about have absolutely nothing. It's none of your business. The 10% that left's over, 95% of that, there ain't nothing you can do about it. 9 out of 10 things ain't going to happen that you worry about, and the one thing that's going to happen is going to happen totally different than you think it's going to happen. So I know you're saying, well, that must mean like 99% of the stuff I think about is total horseshit, and you pretty much got the disease. But you know, we're defiant. That's our chief characteristic. We don't, alcohol is an extreme example of self-aware and right, that they really don't want to think so. You know, and we've got to get rid of this selfishness and this crazy thinking, and God makes that possible. But we don't want to latch on to God, because if we start talking about God, people will laugh at us because cool people don't believe in God. And that shouldn't bother us because we don't really give a crap what other people think about us. But the truth of the matter is, nobody talks about God or Jesus or anything or scripture in the 80s, because what they do is they say people will talk about me after I leave the room, because it's not that they're not curious, it's just that they worry about what other people think about them, even though I know they don't worry about what other people think about them because they don't give a shit what other people think about them, okay? So the bottom line is, so it's like the terrible secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. The whole book has to do with God, but nobody wants to talk about God because we worry about what other people think about us if we talk about God, even though we don't give a shit what other people think about us. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, so you get it. So here's the deal. So what happens is we do this one day at a time thing, because 90% of the stuff you worry about, if you sit down with anybody who's new and you say, what are you worried about? You know what they're going to tell you about? They're going to tell you about something that's going to happen. You understand? They're going to tell you about something that's going to happen. That's something that they know is going to happen. Or something that happened before. They're not going to tell you about anything that's going on like right now. Because like, you know, I used to say to my sponsor, I'd say, you know, I can't, you know, this is blah, blah, blah. And I tell him, I dump all this bullshit on him. And he'd say, well, let me, he says, well, okay, I got you. He says, so how are you doing right now? I said, what do you mean? He'd say, well, how are you doing right now? I said, what do you mean right now? He says, well, how are you doing right now in the back on track group, in the Chris group? I'll go, right now, sitting here right now. I said, what do you mean? How am I doing right now? He says, here right now. You mean right now, sitting here talking to you? Yeah, right now, sitting talking to you. You mean right now, sitting here in this room talking to you, how am I doing right now? He says, yeah, right here, right now, talking to me, how are you doing? I'd say, well, right now I'm doing okay. He said, there you go, and he'd walk away. One time I told him about a guy who bounced a check on me, and he says, he bounced a check, I can't believe it, this is going to happen to them. He says, well, let me ask somewhere else. He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what do you mean? He says, because have you ever had anything happen to you that didn't bother you? No, of course not. Everything bothers you. You know, he says, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I'd say, what do you mean? He says, well, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? What do you mean? If it didn't bother me, the guy bounced a check on me? He says, yeah, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? If it didn't bother me, the guy bounced a check on me, how would I feel? Yeah, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? Well, hell, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel fine. He'd say, there you go, and walk away. So here's the deal. The reason why one day at a time works, now listen, here's the deal, is because we spend 90% of our time worrying about what's going to happen to us. Because we're scared. Because we know. Because you see, when there is no God, and you can't trust anybody, and you're all alone, and nobody will ever help you, and you're a nothing, you've got to be, there's a lot of moving parts out there. There's shit going on. There's bosses, and there's money, and there's stuff. You got to spend a lot of time thinking, like NORAD. You got to have your defenses. You got to know the chess moves down the road. He says this, and then I'll say that. What if I get a call from that guy? What if this guy calls? What happens if mail comes in? What happens with the IRS? I got that note from this guy. You got a million things that you got to figure out. You got to figure out 18 moves down the road and then some. Because if you don't, you're going to die. No probation for us. You know what I mean? All roads lead to death, an agonizing death or humiliation. So you're up all night, 3 o'clock in the morning, worrying about stuff that you can't even, and you may even say to yourself, this is killing me. I got to stop thinking about this. You ever say that? I got to stop thinking about this. And then 5 seconds later, what do? You start thinking about it again, right? You know, you start doing that budget again and everything like that. You can't stop, you know, because you're powerless over your thinking. You can't, because you're addicted to that bolt. You're addicted to the thinking. And so what happens is, you get this thing, the serenity prayer, all these things to live one day at a time. Live in the now. You know, like Bud Dunbar was once out on a pier, you know, an old timer here was out on a pier with one of the sponsees in Key West after a meeting. The sun was going down, and the sponsee says, does it ever get perfect? Does it ever get perfect and wonderful and just perfect where there's no problems? And Bud turned to him and he said, what about right now?
That's right.
What about right now?
That's it.
And he turned around, he looked, and it was perfect. It's always perfect in the now. And so here's what happens. When you focus on the now and what's going on right now, and you stop and you decide, you make the decision, you somehow decide you're going to focus on the now and right now, and not focus on next week, next year, last year. You see what you know what you're saying to yourself, and you don't even know this. You're saying, I've made a decision. You don't even realize you made a decision. God, you said, I've made a decision that I'm not going to worry about that stuff, because it's going to be taken care of. See, I don't have to worry about that stuff because it's going to be taken care of.
Amen.
I don't have to worry about that stuff because it's going to be taken care of. Yes. I can forget about that deal. I'll deal with it sometime because you know why? Somehow, some way, there's some sort of force because my sponsor said whatever it is, it'll be taken care of. And you don't even know what you're doing is you're turning it over to him. You don't even know what him is. All you're knowing is somehow in your mind you're already doing that spiritual exercise where you're learning how to forget what's going to happen in the future, forget about in the past, and turn it over to a power greater than yourself without even knowing you turn it and start focusing on the now. And of course, when you and what you don't even realize that you're starting to live a life of faith rather than a life of fear. And what happens is you're not used to it. You don't know what you're doing. All you know is that when you live in the now and you go to a meeting, you talk about turning it over and all these little silly words we use, all you know is you feel better. You're able to live your life. It's better than drinking. But here's the problem. The problem is when you knew at that deal and you're really immature in the game, the problem is it's very, very tough because you got that, remember, you're crazy. You remember that crazy part? Because part of the craziness is your mind doesn't want to do that because your mind is so used to, you know, next year, focusing on a million things that's going on. It's taking you out towards Venus. You're going there whether you like it or not. It's not like you have control over it. It's not like you're saying, I'm not going to think that way. You're thinking that way because it's taking you there. And that's why sponsors and rooms and books and everything are so, that's why all these tools are so important. That's why you need a guy like Bob Sullivan to say, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? How are you doing right now? That's why you constantly need this reinforcement from outside yourself. You understand what I'm saying? In order to drag you back again until you get more and more used to that life, more and more, and all this is designed to basically help you live a life of faith. Now, why is this God thing important? I don't want to get too far into the third step of what has happened to me. What happened to me is, you know, you can play around with this thing. You can fake it if you make it, and you'll get some relief. But the bottom line is the what happens is, as time goes by, as the trials go by, the more and more you turn your deal over to him, and you start developing a power greater than yourself, and you start developing a faith in God, and you start actually believing it, and your faith goes stronger and stronger through trials and tribulations, where the doctor says, this is what he says. He says, Russell, you've got prostate cancer. And you say, okay, no problem. You know, no problem. Thank you, doctor. And then you leave and you don't worry about it because you know it's going to be taken care of. Because you have a faith, because you're 20 years down the road, you're 20 years, you know, sober. You have a faith in God. You understand? You know it's going to be taken care of one way or the other. Whatever it's going to be for the good. You understand what I'm saying? And it's not even a bump. It's not, okay, just tell me what to do and I'll do it and I'll see you around and I got to go to a meeting.
That's right.
I got to sponsor somebody. And it's like a nothing. So you can deal with some guy who's crying and whining because, you know, he's got a flat tire. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because his life is coming apart because it's just a flat tire. I can't take it anymore. You know? And why? You know why? Because it means absolutely nothing. Because your God is stronger. Is stronger and in charge of anything that's going to happen out there. And there's nothing that can hurt you. And you believe that and you know that. And here's the bottom. It's not about God or no God. It's about whether you want to live a life of faith or you want to live a life of fear. And you listen, this ain't a dress rehearsal. You can live any life. You can go until you're 80 years old, be scared shitless your entire life, and when you're scared shitless, you act scared shitless, you hurt people, you say crappy things, you hurt yourself, you live a dismal life, and then at the end maybe you say, man, why did I do it this way? I guess I should not. I wish I had tried it that Russell way, and then, you know, whatever it is, and then it's too late. Or you have an opportunity to live a life of faith, you know, and have not an ordinary life, but an extraordinary life. And live a life without fear, no matter what happens. Regardless of what you think is happening, you know, to be like the Apostle Paul, who says, I've learned the secret. I've learned how to be content in all things. Rich, poor, doesn't really matter. Doesn't matter whether I have a car, whether I don't have a car, whether I have a job. You know, I mean, I'm not saying anybody lives this thing perfectly. But there's a big difference between somebody who's living a life of fear and somebody living a life of faith. And when you live a life of faith, and all of a sudden you experience a life without fear, of anything, you just experience that life without fear. Drinking is not even an option, it's not even a deal, because it just doesn't even come into the picture. It doesn't come into the picture. You wake up feeling good, you go to sleep feeling good.
That's
right. You know, during the day you're feeling good, because you're concentrating on good things, you know, because there's nothing to concentrate on that's bad, because you're not concentrating on anything that isn't your business. And the only things you're focusing on is things you can actually do something about, and you got the courage to do them, and the stuff that you can't do anything about, you're not worried about, because he's going to handle it anyway. You'd be surprised at how great a life you could live with no thinking. None. Zero. I know you think that's impossible. But let me tell you something. You got, yeah, listen, you guys, every once in a while you gotta go to the bathroom, right? No thinking involved, you just go. You get hungry, right? You gotta eat. No thinking involved, you eat. You get tired, you gotta sleep. No thinking involved, you sleep. You understand what I'm saying? Eating, sleeping, going to the bathroom, that's pretty much it. Anything over that is like problems. So it's like extra, you know? You don't need, it'll all be taken care of. Don't worry about anything. That's Sermon on the Mount. Did you know that Sermon on the Mount was one of the fundamental groups that were books that were absolutely necessary that the old-timers said you had to read during the first 4 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, where Jesus said, don't worry about anything. Do not worry. He says, don't worry, it's all taken care of. And the alkies are saying, what the hell is this guy talking about? And he's talking about living an incredible life, and that's what A's talking about. That's why at the end of the book, the last line, it says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That's why the book is all about that. That's why they say at the beginning of the book, we experienced much of heaven, we've been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. The central fact of our life is this, that he lives in our hearts and minds in a way which is indeed miraculous. He's doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. That's why the whole book is about God. That's why we have the 11th step, where you finally wind up focusing on God and trying to have more God and a better relationship with God, and then you tell people about that. That's why the whole book is about God. As much as alcoholics want to tear him out of this and want to make it about psychology and all sorts of psychological stuff, which, by the way, hasn't really worked for you. I don't know if you've noticed that. You've been to all the psychiatrists before you got here. It didn't really work. They gave you pills. Got you crazier. Probably worked for some of you, you know. But it may work as an adjunct, okay? But the number one thing is to focus on him, that power, so you don't have to worry anymore and be scared. So next week we'll talk about step 3. Thank you.